This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. John Jeremiah Sullivan is a journalist, but not the fact-finding kind. He writes long pieces that begin with his own obsessive interest in some tiny corner of culture or moment in history. He fans out from this interest into the higher reaches of contemporary thought, connecting his personal story with our collective experience. He's applied his artistry to everything from a massive Christian rock festival to his brother's near-death experience and his own house in Wilmington, which was part of the set for the teen television melodrama called One Tree Hill. John Jeremiah Sullivan is a contributing writer for GQ magazine and the New York Times magazine, and a regular contributor to several other noteworthy publications. His nonfiction has been collected in a new book, Pulphead. He reads tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tomorrow, but he's with us in the studio right now. John, welcome to State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
You have written about your house in Wilmington in the essay Peyton's Place that was part of the set for One Tree Hill. So what made that house so special?
I don't know how special it really is, and that was an awkwardness, because I think there were some people in the neighborhood who wondered why this house and not ours, and there was no good answer. But I think it had a very solid brick look, and so for a director who wanted to convey, you know, solidity, it was a good shorthand.
Was it crazy for you to see your house on television? I assume you must have seen it at least once on TV. This is the place where I live, and now it's rendered here as this other entity.
Yeah, I've seen it many times on TV because, of course, we started watching the show at first in order to watch for our house, but then pretty easily got sucked up into the melodrama.
You talk about the dissonance in sort of having a place to live in. This is my house. And then what they do with it as a set, and then they turn it back to you, pretty well kept. I mean, they do a nice job.
Oh, extremely well kept. Yeah. In fact, usually it was nicer and neater when we got home than it was when we left. But it was a little metaphysically disturbing almost, because you'd come home and know that these very dramatic and in some cases violent things had happened there in your house, but everything looked perfect and you had no real memory of them. And later you'd see them on television. It was just hard to know what to do with it.
You know? Horrible episode in your basement.
Yes. Two high school age girls were tied up, presumably as a prelude to some horrible act. But they did get free and killed their assailant on our staircase.
It's fascinating to think that you really can't disassociate yourself with that. I mean, you know, you're a very smart guy. You know it's a TV show, and yet I live here.
Yeah.
And they're shooting this show.
Yeah, it was hard not to feel that it would be material at some point.
You eventually broke up with One Tree Hill. What happened?
Nothing too terrible. I think I was starting to feel weirder and weirder about doing it. We had a young daughter, and I wasn't sure what she was making of the experience of periodically moving out of the house and then moving right back in. Some petty thing came up, a dispute over money, as will happen in any kind of rental situation like that, and we just used it as an excuse to back out.
Your essays really do start, it seems, from a heartfelt interest in some essential part of the subject, and then work out into the sort of the objective material you're covering. And maybe we could use the first essay in the book, Upon This Rock, as a kind of object lesson. Tell us about that essay.
I think what you're saying is true. I tend to seek out subjects that have a connection to some kind of obsessive interest of mine, and so the reporting of the story, the research for the story, becomes a kind of working out of a problem almost.
But that suggests that you've really thought about this thing before you went into it. You have an idea about it.
Usually that's the case, yeah. The research and the thinking about it are not being done purely to make the deadline. It's something that's been a concern of mine, I guess, for a while. And the essay you're talking about is a perfect example, because I had a pretty intense evangelical period when I was younger, like a lot of people, and they sent me back to cover this huge Christian rock festival, and so I ended up spending a week with people who were, in an almost eerie way, just like I had been 15 years before, 10 or 15 years before, and so it was one of those cases where to keep out the personal, to keep out the first person would almost have been a disservice to the story, because I did have some perspective on it.
And yet, as a cultural critic, as someone who's thought about particularly music, you bring a kind of critical evaluation to the material as well. Maybe I could have you read for us to give us a sense of what we're talking about.
Sure, happily. This is a description of one of the bands that the guys I was hanging out with there at the festival kept dragging me back to the stage to hear these Christian rock bands they were really into. And this is, I'm describing a band called Jars of Clay. For their encore, Jars of Clay did a cover of U2's All I Want Is You. It was bluesy. That's the last thing I'll be saying about the bands. Or no, wait, there's this. The fact that I didn't hear a single interesting bar of music from the 40 or so acts I caught or overheard at Creation shouldn't be read as a knock against the acts themselves, much less as contempt for the underlying notion of Christians playing rock. These were not Christian bands, you see. These were Christian rock bands. The key to digging this scene lies in that one-syllable distinction. Christian rock is a genre that exists to edify and make money off of evangelical Christians. It's message music for listeners who know the message cold. And what's more, it operates under a perceived responsibility, one the artists embrace, to reach people. As such, it rewards both obviousness and maximum palatability. The artists would say clarity, which in turn means parasitism. Remember those perfume dispensers they used to have in pharmacies? If you like Dracar Noir, you'll love Sexy Musk. Well, Christian rock works like that. Every successful, crappy secular group has its Christian off-brand. And that's proper, because culturally speaking, it's supposed to serve as a stand-in for, not an alternative to or an improvement on, those very groups. In this, it succeeds wonderfully.
John Jeremiah Sullivan reading from an essay called Upon This Rock, one of a collection in his new collection called Pulpit. He's reading at the Regulator tonight on our show today. I think that's a great example of your ability to sort of critically evaluate the music, but keep an open mind. I mean, this is not an attack on the folks who showed up there. It could have been easy to tee off on the kind of, you know, clean-cut all-American Christians with the rapture in their eyes, but you don't do that. You're really looking at these guys, trying to figure out what's the essence of their authenticity, what drives them, and then what are the, yeah, superficial kind of commercial overlays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I never let go completely of the idea that the music is turning me off. Because I think at that point, I think I would begin to be dishonest to the reader. But I try to open the lens gradually as I'm discovering myself as a reporter and as a narrator that what's going on there is a lot more complicated than I'd known going in. I try to let that work on the piece and give the reader the same sense that the sort of narrow irony that we went into this essay through is not going to serve. There's a lot going on here, and we have to try to understand it on its own terms to really know anything about it.
How do you do that as a writer or as a person to go in with a deep idea, a well thought out idea, and yet remain open to the surprise?
I think you just have to be ready to scuttle everything you think you know. It's similar to going into an interview. You over-prepare, you come in with a list of 20 questions, but if that isn't what the subject feels like talking about, then you crumple it up. And you have to be ready to do the same thing mentally and psychologically, I think, when you go into a piece like that.
Do you go in expecting that to happen? Or let me put it this way. Do you go in wanting that to happen, to have something about your prejudice overturned and upended?
I would say both. I go in wanting and expecting it to happen. And when it doesn't happen, It's funny how many times that means the piece isn't going to work out, you know, because it's not that interesting when the material ends up confirming what you already thought you knew. That probably means that whatever it is happening at a fairly shallow level, you know.
There's another interesting problem that I think you reveal here for the writer, and it comes about a page before the section you just read. You write, "I suspect that at some level, the conscious ones say, I didn't want to be noticing what I'd noticed as we went." The idea that you as the reporter among these rock concert fans couldn't be exposed as the anthropological outsider reporting on their, because suddenly then you're going to get a different picture of them. Once they see you evaluating them, it's not the same picture.
That's true. I think I was feeling at that moment in the piece something start to open up, a crack start to open up, and it was going to be the crack through which I'd begin talking about my own past, my own faith, my own doubts about my doubts, for lack of a better phrase, you know, and I knew that at that point the piece would really swerve personal, and so that was a little stutter step of hesitation maybe before that happened, and wanting to hold on to my magazine distance, you know.
When you embed yourself like this, how much do you think you have to reveal about yourself, and how much should you conceal as the reporter?
I don't think you have to conceal or reveal anything, and you know, every writer figures out his or her strategy, you know, how much of that works, and at what point it begins to hurt pieces and make them self-indulgent and tedious. So, you know, I tend to answer those questions purely in dialogue with the subject, the immediate subject, the thing I'm working on. Then I feel like it will dictate to you how much of you, how much of that first person is going to be allowed in that piece.
I talked about your interest in music, and one of the great interests for you is Michael Jackson. How did you get interested in him?
I'd always been fascinated by Michael Jackson. When I was growing up as a kid in Indiana, he was a god, and he's always been the one artist who makes it possible for me to understand what people mean when they talk about Elvis, you know, back in the 50s or the Beatles. And so he'd always been part of my imagination. And when he died, I really wanted to write something about him, but it didn't look like it was going to work out. The magazine had already assigned something, but it fell through, and there was kind of a window there.
Well, you write about Michael Jackson and Axl Rose in their back-to-back essays, I would say almost companion pieces. Were those pieces similar for you in terms of your sort of trying to explore something in your own interior?
It's funny. I came at them differently. My wife, Mariana Johnson, who teaches at the college in UNCW and is also an avid pop culture consumer, she suggested the Axl piece to me. But as I was writing, I can't remember at what point in the writing of those two pieces, but there came a point where I started to realize how much they had in common. And they're not two singers that people would ever think to put together in the same room. But
Axl Rose, just for your information, if you don't know, the lead singer in Guns N' Roses.
Thank you. Yes, I should remember. This is not necessarily a household thing anymore.
Not anymore. That's not a problem. Yeah.
You know, both from Indiana, both great male pop dancers, both ended up changing their bodies in dramatic ways. They go together better than I ever knew starting out.
What was it? Did you have a sense, though, that there was something you wanted to explore, you know, an interest of yours? I mean, what was the sort of fundamental interest that you had in
it? It probably had something to do with Indiana as a kind of void in the middle of the country. I say that as someone who grew up there. There's a special nowhereness to Indiana that I don't think any other state can quite claim.
That's a problem. That's a problem, isn't it, for writers? This sense that a place is a character. It has characteristics. You don't want a stereotype. You don't want a gloss. And yet you know there's something to say about this place that makes it unique.
Yes. I think a lot of times that sense of place thing becomes sort of a glib piece of advice that you need to put a mule in the yard and, you know, have an old man sitting on the porch in order to give sense of place. But what it's really talking about is the effect of landscape on character, on personality, and how, you know, people are different who come from places that look and feel different. I've noticed that just moving to Wilmington, living on that sort of sun-scoured coastal plain with no valleys, no place to hide. For the first couple of years, I felt very agoraphobic. So, Michael and Axl were two subjects where you could find that happening.
What brought you to Wilmington?
I'm not sure. My wife and I we were ready to get out of New York. We'd been there about 6 years, and she's from Greensboro, so Wilmington was kind of a summer beach place for her. So we moved
in. Wife brings the guy back to North Carolina. It's an old trope. Old trope. That, and you were fans of One Tree Hill. Come on, admit it.
Have been a little One Tree Hill stalking going on.
Are there some subjects, particularly, let's say, in music that you haven't covered yet that you really want to?
There are so many. I may be writing something about REM soon for the Times Magazine, which I hope happens, because they were one of the first important bands for me. My brother sort of brought them home from college when I was about 11. And I've also always wanted to write something about this new breed of super producer that exists now in pop music. These people who never leave the studio, for the most part, are kind of, overweight and sitting around in sports jerseys. And, not people we associate with pop glitter and stardom at all, but who are almost godlike in their ability to create hits and make acts. And I've been looking for a way to approach that story.
Hasn't that always been part of the music industry, though?
I think it comes and goes. There are times when songwriters and artists are really privileged and put forward more, and then times when they become a kind of secondary thing to the making of the music. But so this is, in a way, a return to a Brill Building model, but in a different guise. That's sort of how I want to write about it.
It may tell us more about the way we listen, I suppose, than the way the industry is moving.
I'm always hoping for that. I'm a failed songwriter myself, which gave me an interest in the math of songwriting and the science of it. And anytime I get access to these people who are actual great musicians, I try to learn more about that.
I mean, these are people who are literally, as you talk about the math, they're taking a note out to change the rhythm by an eighth or
exactly.
a 26th of a second. And it's
exactly.
All the difference.
And they have an almost biological understanding of the way the ear reacts to certain moves, songwriting moves. Simon Cowell was a person who, of American Idol fame, I visited him at his house for a GQ piece. It's at the very top of Beverly Hills. He has a house that looks sort of like a spaceship. You've seen it in movies, probably. It sort of hangs out over the valley. He actually lives there. And it was fascinating to listen to him talk about, the ability of pop music to manipulate and trying to master that. But he's coming from a completely different place than a songwriter. Than some of the songwriters I also ended up interviewing. There was continuity there.
He had that intuitive sense that's what's going on.
Yes.
Almost as a critic. So you're writing for magazines. You've got some great assignments these days, New York Times Magazine, GQ. You've written for others. Yet magazines seem to be going out of business. I mean, what's the future for that business? Is it all going online, and is it the same thing?
I don't know. I've been insulated from it a little bit because my bread and butter for several years was GQ, and they were doing well. Their subscriptions were going up, so there was never a feeling of panic. Now I feel lucky to be at the New York Times because they've been one of the smartest publications in moving stuff over to the web and starting to graft their identity onto that a little bit for some kind of future change. So I'm just hunkered down. Mostly, though, I think that stuff is overstated. Writers will always be necessary. Somebody has to string the words together.
Well said. John, thanks so much. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
John Jeremiah Sullivan, his new book called Pulphead. It is a collection of essays he reads tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham at 7 o'clock and tomorrow at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill again at 7. Coming up after a short break, it's been 20 years since Clarence Thomas was confirmed as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you remember those contentious hearings? What have we learned? What has changed? And what has stayed the same? Duke Professor Carla Holloway joins us to look back at Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, on the state of things. Stay tuned.